If Philip died for a name, it was for our name, Eliza. Alexander interrupted, as if to fend me off, one hand to his eyes to shield me from seeing the tears gathering there. But I would not be fended off. You were alone as a child, but Philip never was. Not a moment of his entire life did he feel abandoned or unloved. That's why he loved to laugh. He died because of me. He died because a Jacobin murdered him, I replied, with complete conviction. My son hadn't been the only one to quarrel with George Eaker, after all. One of Philip's friends had also been caught up in the same incident. Captain Eaker let that other boy, the son of nobody in particular, go unharmed. But he shot the son of Alexander Hamilton. He shot Philip dead. He would never face justice for it. In Jefferson's America, he'd be applauded. We had long feared the blade of a guillotine, but a bullet had done the job just as well. I need you, I said, and Alexander came at once to my embrace. Then you shall have me. Wife, children, and hobby are the only things upon which I permit my thoughts to run. Because I need you as well, my dear Eliza. More than you shall ever understand. We stood there, holding one another in love and mutual comfort until our hearts beat in time. And I wish I could say that was the end of it. That with those words, with that embrace, with that understanding, we healed each other's wounds. But any parent who has lost a child will tell you that grief is a monster less vanquished than held at bay. That like love, survival is a choice to be made anew every morning. And sometimes one must pretend at being healed just to get through the day. Alas, my husband was not a man who could comfortably pretend at anything. Chapter 34. The African Venus is said to officiate as housekeeper at Monticello. James Callender. September 1802. Harlem. Have you seen this? Angelica cried, bursting into our house with a stack of newspapers. I knew it must be important for her to have made the trip from the city, especially when she didn't bother to remove her coat or hat before racing into the parlor. My stomach knotted the moment she laid the papers before me, because they were copies of the Richmond Recorder, where that despicable scandal-monger, James Callender, plied his vicious trade. How many years had he hounded us? How cruelly he'd aimed his poisoned pen at my family in exposing the Reynolds affair. And even though Angelica's expression was peculiar, something between fury and glee, I told myself that I mustn't be surprised by the depths to which the paper might sink to hurt us now. But I was surprised. For the article was not aimed at us, but at Thomas Jefferson, the President of the United States, who, it breathlessly revealed to the world, had for many years kept an enslaved woman for his mistress. We'd known this, of course. Given my sister's intimacy with Jefferson, she was privy to a number of his secret liaisons, including one with this enslaved mulatto, Sally Hemings. And whispers said she was the half-sister of his dead wife, besides. I took some petty satisfaction that Jefferson might suffer for this, but it was all very unseemly and uncomfortable to see anyone's intimate life splashed across the papers again. When I said as much, Angelica shook her head. "Keep reading. Where is Hamilton?" She went to the tall windows overlooking the veranda and squinted. What the devil is he doing out there in the dirt? He was planting 13 sweet gum trees this morning, one for each of the original colonies. I'm not sure what he's doing now. A garden is a very usual refuge of a disappointed politician, he explained a few minutes later when we went outside to show him the news. For Angelica had been right. There was something we didn't already know. That indecent creature, that reptile Callender, had been paid to destroy us. 13 years ago, Jefferson hired him to print seditious libels, I said, indignantly shaking the page before Alexander's eyes. I wasn't sure if we should frame it, set it afire, or bury it as fertilizer in the garden. But what I was sure of was that we'd been vindicated. All those years ago, Jefferson paid Callender to write that Washington was a traitor, a robber, and a perjurer. Paid him to print foul slanders against President Adams and against you. Dark eyes flashing, Angelica added, "And now that Jefferson is president and won't pay any more, the serpent turns and bites the hand that fed him." Alexander had always suspected as much, but now seemed taken aback by our vehemence and heaved a great sigh. "We live in a world full of evil." I blinked. That was all he had to say about it? The man who'd once designed governments had set his mind on our farm, deciding the ground of our orchard was too wet, that we must have grass, that we must plant watermelons, and that our cows must not be allowed to range. We'd kept our heads ducked since Jefferson took the presidency. And what had our reward been? A dead son. Our fears of guillotines in the street were not realized. My husband had perhaps been right to believe Jefferson a more cautious man than I had supposed. But if we were going to live in this country, if we were going to remain vulnerable to his rabid followers, then I did not think we should passively endure it. And truthfully, anger felt so much better than grief. Alexander, you gave Jefferson the presidency. You and that horrific clause in the Constitution that allows slaves to be counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation. Jefferson would have never been elected otherwise, and now he disgraces the place he unjustly fills and produces immorality by his example. If this bit about the scandalmonger is true, Jefferson must be abominably wicked and weak. I think you have a duty to the Constitution.
Perhaps no man has sacrificed or done more for the present Constitution than myself, Alexander said, bracing his hands upon the shovel's pole. I've labored to prop the frail and worthless fabric in spite of all my predictions that it will fail. Yet I have the murmurs of its friends no less than the curses of its foes for reward. Every day proves to me more and more that this American world was not made for me. What can I do better than withdraw?
I hated to see him in surrender. I'd married, after all, a soldier, a hero. Not a sad, fatalistic man, but a fractious firebrand. And I wanted him back. I wanted the Alexander I'd always known and loved. Later, when my sister went inside to fetch us cider, I told him, "You must engage the world again."
"I never stopped,"
he protested, reminding me of the near daily 18-mile round trips he made to his new office on Garden Street in town.
"My practice of law remains a vigorous undertaking."
But the cases he handled now were only of the mundane variety and of no great import, the kind that didn't tax his talents or set precedents. He had, of course, almost as if in a compulsion, never stopped writing essays. Amongst them, The Examination, which tore apart all President Jefferson's policies. And he had, at my repeated urging, finally assisted with the publication of a newly bound collection of The Federalist. But when our peg-legged friend, Mr. Morris, pleaded with Alexander to take a more active role, perhaps even to run for political office, my husband refused. And I'd been glad. But now I thought I'd been wrong. For all the years I'd complained of it, the squalid brawling of the public arena was part of Hamilton's makeup, like hair, teeth, or bones. So I said, "I think you should defend the Federalist newspaper man Jefferson is now trying to imprison under the sedition laws he claimed to hate. And Papa agrees." Out of a desire to shield my husband's vulnerabilities from other eyes, any other eyes, I'd waited for Angelica's departure to lobby for this idea. But I'd set my sister on him, too, if need be. Alexander laughed.
You want me to battle President Jefferson. In a courtroom.
I glared at him for laughing. Someone has to. When I was younger, I often asked why it couldn't be someone else. Why did it always have to be Alexander Hamilton to jump into the fray? And I'd complained, on more than one occasion, of his obsessive need to be at the center of history in the making. I resolved now to never complain of it again. At my insistence, Alexander relented and took the case against the newspaper man who'd been brave enough to reveal that Jefferson had paid James Callender to print slanders against all manner of public and private men. The case hinged on two constitutional issues: freedom of the press and trial by jury. Alexander also, to my chagrin, waived the fee. But I didn't mind so much when I saw our older boys gathered around their father as he explained his plan to establish a constitutional principle that truth must always be a defense against charges of slander and libel. And I could see that our boys all adored their father and wished to follow in his footsteps, especially when he confided in them his intention to subpoena President Jefferson himself and confront him with testimony by the infamous James Callender. But on the morning I lined up our boys outside the courtroom in their Sunday best to listen to their father argue the case, Alexander whispered with a colleague, then sat down hard on the steps where I knelt, tying Johnny's cravat, which he'd pulled loose again. "He's dead," Hamilton said, removing his top hat and holding it as if he'd never seen it before. "Who?" I asked, alarmed by my husband's sudden gray pallor.
"Callender," he said. "Drowned, they say."
Before Alexander could transport Callender to the courtroom to give testimony that would have harmed the president, the scoundrel was found dead, floating in the James River near Richmond. Some said a victim of his own drunken excesses. Others said he'd been murdered to keep him quiet. And it was as sobering a reminder of how deadly politics could be. Alexander wasn't permitted to subpoena the president, and he lost the trial. Regardless, my husband made an argument that moved men to tears, his voice thundering in the courtroom while he paced like the revolutionary lion he had once been, the spark of a young firebrand still flashing in his eyes and setting my heart aflame. Later, all the city's leaders praised it as one of his greatest speeches, perhaps his greatest. And I was so glad my boys were in attendance when Hamilton concluded his remarks by saying, "I never did think the truth was a crime. I'm glad the day has come in which it is to be decided, for my soul has ever abhorred the thought that a free man dare not speak the truth." "And that," I thought with inordinate pride, "is Alexander Hamilton." That was who the history books should remember. Yet now I think, in the end, it wasn't my pride in him, or the trial, or his opposition to Jefferson's presidency that brought him back to himself. It was Aaron Burr.
"You have attributed to Burr the most atrocious and unprincipled of crimes. If he has not called upon you, he is either guilty or the most despicable bastard in the universe, so degraded as to permit even General Hamilton to slander him with impunity."
James Cheatham, editor of The American Citizen. Burr was a man without a party. By contesting the tie election in 1800, he had gambled and lost. Jefferson despised him. He was vice president in name only. So, naturally, he was now running for governor of New York, and he was doing it against his fellow Republican, Morgan Lewis, the trial judge Alexander had argued before in the libel case, in a move that split that party in two. "Burr can't win," I said, nearly laughing at the preposterousness of it. Burr was universally detested as a lecher and an immoral cheat, even by those who'd voted for him.
"Eliza," my husband said, with an impatient tone he used only when a law clerk was slow to understand him. Not a single Federalist has come forward to run against either of them.
That was the state of our party's demoralization, given the mud that would inevitably be slung at anyone who dared to serve an ungrateful public. Perhaps democracy would always naturally devolve to a state when only a man like Burr, a greedy libertine without any care for what the world might say about him, would stand for election. For what gentleman could ever wish to expose his wife and children to the calumnies that had been visited upon us? "Do you mean to run for the governorship?" I asked, upon a hard swallow, bracing myself to support him wholeheartedly if he were to say yes. But Alexander barked a laugh.
"And damn the state, if not the whole country, when I lose? No. You've seen how people greet me at polling stations."
Reluctantly, I admitted, "You have perhaps a character too frank and independent for a democratic people, at least in the present climate."
"Unfortunately, my angel, you have the right of it. But something must be done."
He shook his head and thumped his hand on the table. In the days that followed, it became increasingly clear that Alexander was right. Something must be done. Because Burr wasn't merely running for governor. He was also encouraging a new movement in northern states angered by Jefferson's purchase of the Louisiana Territory. Northerners feared that the new lands would favor slavery, and their solution was secession.
"Burr won't be satisfied until he breaks this union," Alexander raged inside the little room by the front door that he'd commandeered as his office and painted an incongruously cheerful shade of green. "How quickly people forget all that for which we fought."
Even though I feared he'd disturb Anna where she sat peacefully stitching a pillow, or awaken the baby upstairs in the nursery, I was pleased to see that leonine spark return to his eye. It was as if he believed himself again, a winter soldier fighting frightening odds in a war for the country itself. Which is why you must remind them by recruiting a Federalist to run against Burr. So we hosted a dinner party. A lavish one, where, having banished the children upstairs, we threw open the doors and hired musicians to play on the grounds. We accepted the compliments of everyone as they entered the front hall and saw the elegant painting of Washington and the bust of Alexander when he was Secretary of the Treasury, carved in the style of a Roman senator. I worked the men's wives, trying to detect if any of their husbands should be willing to stand as a candidate for governor. And Angelica, still beguiling in a gown of blue satin with a golden belt, embroidered in the pattern of a Greek key, tried to recruit promising men to the cause. Amidst the clink of glasses and forks upon my pink and yellow floral china plates, I overheard my husband say to his old faithful Federalist lieutenants,
"For God's sake, cease these threats about a separation in the Union. It must hang together as long as it can be made to."
If Burr got in, there'd be no more United States, he believed, just North and South, but still no Federalist would run, leaving Alexander with an unthinkable alternative. Once again, he'd have to champion a Republican. First Jefferson, now Morgan Lewis. Finally, he set his mind to do just that, and the campaign against Aaron Burr began in deadly earnest. Alexander made speeches against Burr, held forth at dinner parties, and used whatever sway he still possessed to argue against Burr's candidacy. As if unable to save our son, Alexander became determined to at least save the Union. The newspapers joined in, accusing Burr of all manner of disgraceful debauchery, consorting with prostitutes and other men's wives, seducing fine ladies and enslaved women alike, fathering bastards, and even hosting a Negro ball to court the free black vote. Alexander was not responsible for the calumny thrown Burr's way, but many suspected him of it, and they were entertained.
but the newspapers were in earnest with their blood sport. Our son, Alex, had seldom shown interest in politics. That had been his older brother's fiefdom. Alex was now nearing college graduation, and because he had a head for numbers like his grandfather, we wished to place him in a counting house to be a merchant. He already had an offer to work in Boston after his graduation, which pleased my mother's pride. But now his brow furrowed. "The papers are trying to goad Father and Colonel Burr to fight." I took the papers from him. "Worry not. Your father is too wise now to be lured into such a trap." May 1804, Harlem. Burr lost the governorship by a great majority, which gave my husband satisfaction. He'd worried that he was washed up, helpless, and without any influence in the country he helped found. This victory proved otherwise, for Hamilton's campaigning had ensured Burr's defeat. To celebrate, we took our children to the now raucous Pinkster Festival in the city, where we mingled amongst our black citizens with a measure of gratification that though more must be done to achieve the freedom of all, every child born in New York was now born free. We also hosted a dinner party for Jerome Bonaparte, a 19-year-old naval officer of middling rank who currently stood in defiance of his conquering brother Napoleon. Against the wishes of the French dictator, Jerome had married an American girl, Elizabeth Patterson, the Belle of Baltimore, as some called her. And presented with the opportunity to make mischief for the French tyrant by befriending his willful younger brother, Alexander was delighted, laughing and conversing in French, and telling stories of the Marquis de Lafayette that kept young Bonaparte rapt. Hamilton toasted old friends and new with a case of Papa's fine Madeira we'd had shipped from Albany for the occasion. And being the gracious and solicitous host who greeted every guest by name, he recalled with each one a fond memory of how they'd met or some battle they'd fought. Watching Alexander entertain, I took my first deep, easy breath in as long as I could remember. Was that happiness that had finally crept back after the losses of recent years? As the season turned and the weather warmed, I was struck by a new mildness in my dear Hamilton, and was sure that he felt it too. A peacefulness, even. Our victory over Burr had imparted to Alexander an eased mind and a lightened heart. Why, at the annual 4th of July celebration of the Society of the Cincinnati, my nearly 50-year-old husband led the men in singing old songs while standing atop a table. But spending time with other sons of the Revolution, recalling all that they'd sacrificed and all that we'd won, had always had a salutary effect upon him. Which was why, when he proposed that we host a lavish ball at the Grange and produced a guest list of over 70 people, I could only find myself delighted. "I promised you a ball, my darling girl," he said, "and a promise must never be broken." Excited by the prospect of such a grand affair, much grander than any entertainment we'd hosted before, I didn't mind the work involved, even with 2-year-old Phil, 4-year-old Lisbeth, and 6-year-old William underfoot. Happily, in that, Anna was a help, directing them in making garlands of silk ribbon, rosebuds, marigolds, and daylilies, snipped fresh from our gardens. Anna might not remember what year it was or which of her relations dwelt in this world or the next, but she was still my beloved daughter, and she had a sweet, attentive way with the little ones. Meanwhile, having taken their height from their grandfather, our tall Alex, James, and Johnny strung the garlands between the house and the trees, and carried chairs out of doors because their father wished this ball to be al fresco, in the French fête champêtre style. The help of my darlings, and a French servant Angelica sent for the occasion, freed me to see to the menu with the assistance of our inestimable Mr. Genty, whose cooking, using the produce of our garden, always brought the highest praise. I anticipated raspberry tarts and fresh strawberry jam shortbread cookies. And the children wished to make their father a cherry pie, so I made sure Mr. Genty included it on the menu. My gown for the occasion was an oyster-colored silk satin, with an embroidered bodice and hem in a leaf design, and a beaded overskirt, an extravagant purchase Alexander insisted upon. How many years had passed since I last dressed in such finery? I couldn't recall. And examining myself in the mirror of my toilette, I found myself pleased. Bearing 8 children had not spoiled my figure entirely. At the age of 46, and having nursed 8 children, my breasts had lost their shape and my hips were wider than I would have liked. But my waist was still slender, and my hair was only a little silvered. If I were to have met the woman in the mirror as a stranger, I might think her dignified and handsome. As I gazed at my image, Alexander stole upon me to fasten my necklace. "Best of wives and best of women," he whispered, kissing my nape below the graying brown curls of my upswept hair. "As beautiful as the day we met. At a different ball, as I recall it." I turned in his arms and smoothed my hands over the lapels of his pinstriped silk taffeta dress coat. "And you, even more charming now, you were, after all, a little insufferable in those days." He laughed, leaning his forehead against mine. "How I love you and our precious children. Oh, to still have this tender affection between us after all these years." There was a serenity about him as he held out his arm. "Come, let us join the revelry." And what a gay revelry it was. The late day air was perfect, warm without being hot, breezy and refreshing for strolls through our gardens. Wandering musicians delighted our guests, a special touch upon which Alexander had insisted. When the sun set, lanterns and flowers hung from the trees, creating a colorful, fragrant ballroom under the purple heavens. All New York's best society attended. John Trumbull, the silver-haired artist of the Revolution, who'd once painted a life-size portrait of Alexander that now hung in our hall. Nicholas Fish and Robert Troop, fellow Federalists with whom Alexander had served in the New York militia at the very beginnings of their careers. Nabby Adams Smith, daughter of President Adams and her husband, and even William Short, one-time secretary to Thomas Jefferson when he'd been the American minister to France, who had himself become a diplomat. We danced and imbibed until midnight, until Alexander and I were the only ones still dancing, and the children had fallen asleep on a blanket at the edge of the lantern's light. And the next morning we rode into town and attended services at Trinity Church, where we gave thanks for it all, our lives, our friends, our family, and the Union itself. That evening found us out of doors again, having a family picnic under the trees in the grove. Lying in the grass, surrounded by our children, my head against my husband's side, our fingers interlocked, we stared up at the heavens until the stars shone. I smiled at Alexander and thought, this is what peace truly feels like. To be at ease with the ones I loved, for once. We've earned this. We've fought and clawed and survived to have this. Drowsiness overtook me as Alexander told stories to our sons, who hung on their father's every word, about how the gods placed constellations amongst the stars to honor the service of legendary mortals.
"What kind of honor is that?"
Johnny asked, rapt despite the question.
"Oh, a very great honor,"
Alexander said, ruffling the boy's hair.
"For they are memorialized for all time, so that even here and now I can tell you their stories."
And then he pressed a kiss to my temple and spoke of the heavens just for me.
"Doubt thou the stars are fire," Alexander whispered Shakespeare against my hair.
doubt that the sun doth move. Doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love.
Chapter 35. July 11th, 1804, Harlem.
Mama, someone's at the door,
Lisbeth said, dancing in front of it while William sat on the floor playing with a set of marbles.
Yes, yes, I'm coming,
I said, giving my youngest daughter a smile. She looked so much like I imagined I must have at her age. Dark hair, dark eyes, and a smile that came to life any time we ventured outside into the gardens or the grove of trees. I pulled open the door to find a man standing hat in hand, his head bent.
Yes. May I help you?
Mrs. Hamilton,
he asked, just barely meeting my eye.
Ma'am, I've been asked to send for you. There's been, well, you see, General Hamilton has need of you.
He gestured to the horses behind him.
I've brought a carriage.
Despite the growing warmth of the day, ice tingled down my spine.
What's happened?
I asked, keeping my voice even for the children. The man couldn't seem to meet my eyes.
The general isn't well. He has spasms.
His kidneys again? Just when I thought Alexander was over his old ailment.
I'll wait in the carriage,
he said, hurrying down the steps. In a matter of minutes, the four children and I were on our way. I took solace in knowing that the older boys had gone into the city with Alexander 2 mornings before when he'd departed on his weekly trip to his office. At 18 and 16, Alex and James could look after him until I arrived. The trip was faster than I expected, given that it was the middle of a fine Wednesday. That is, until we began to encounter small crowds of people on every street corner, a buzz over some news I couldn't make out. And then I was distracted from that oddity when the driver turned the wrong way.
Sir, driver, where are you taking us?
Mr. Bayard's house,
the man called in reply. I didn't have time to process that before I heard my name. From the crowd. Again and again.
Look, it's Mrs. General Hamilton, his poor wife.
A dark, hazy memory assaulted me. The crowds. The crowds in front of Angelica's house when my son was shot dead. And my heart began to hammer. Then it all but stopped when the carriage slowed in the drive before Mr. Bayard's grand mansion on the river, where another crowd parted like the Red Sea as the driver guided us through. Wailing. The women were wailing, and gloom hung on every man's face. We'd barely come to a halt when I sprung from the carriage unassisted, my voice shaking with certain knowing dread. Not well, I said to the driver when he offered his hand.
You said the general was not well.
I saw the truth in his eyes before he spoke.
He asked me to give you hope.
Bile crawled up my throat as I remembered what Alexander once said to me.
I thought you might take easier to a thing if it was gradually broken to you, my angel.
He was wrong then, and he was wrong now. Already moving toward the house, I rasped to Anna, "Stay here, all of you."
Oh, merciful God, why? Alexander,
I cried, finding him amidst onlookers gathered round Mr. Bayard's grand bed. And when my husband's head turned to me, it nearly took me to my knees. I'd seen that look before. The gray pallor of blood loss, the waxy sheen of fever, the cloudy eyes of laudanum. The look of death.
Eliza,
Alexander wheezed.
My angel.
Taking his hand, I nearly collapsed onto the edge of the bed, and that's when I saw the bloodied bandages around his waist. I knew the truth before it was even explained to me. He'd been shot. He'd been shot in a duel. Voices I could barely hear recounted how he'd met Aaron Burr across the Hudson upon the cliffs of Weehawken, New Jersey. How, like my son, Alexander had thrown away his fire, how his opponent had taken lethal aim anyway.
"Will he live?"
I asked the doctors, panic squeezing my throat and making it hard to choke out the words. 4 doctors huddled in the room. 2 Americans and 2 French surgeons, I later learned, were stationed on a frigate in the harbor, who were much experienced with gunshot wounds. The French had been our saviors in the Revolution. Maybe their expertise could save us now.
"Can you save him? Please save him?"
"Mrs. General Hamilton."
One of the doctors finally stepped forward, wearing an expression of brutal sympathy, an expression mirrored on the other men's faces.
"I'm afraid the bullet has fractured a rib and, I suspect, ruptured the general's liver. The bullet remains lodged in his spine."
I could hear no more. I couldn't see, couldn't think, couldn't speak. This couldn't be happening again. How could it possibly be happening again? Was I, like my eldest daughter, caught in some delusion, except in my waking dream everyone I loved was to be taken from me? Frantic with grief, I sobbed a desperate prayer to a god who had already required so many sacrifices from me. Not Alexander, too. Not my dear Hamilton. Though his weak pulse yet gave proof of life, I already sensed his withdrawal from me. And I felt his loss in my bones, in my flesh, as if the very heart of me was being violently rent asunder. It was an unbearable agony of spirit. One loss too many and far too soon. As I wept and bargained and prayed and raged, Alexander murmured, "Remember, my Eliza, you are a Christian." The first time he said it, pale and aware of his impending death, I believed he was offering me consolation, beseeching me to find comfort in my religion. Delirious with pain, he murmured it again as Angelica arrived, weeping her heart out as if joy no longer existed in the world and never could. And I couldn't decide if my sister's anguish halved or doubled mine. I fanned Alexander's feverish face and mopped his brow, and when his precious blood soaked through the bandages and the mattress to pool upon the floor beneath the bed, I begged Bishop Moore to consent to give my husband communion, despite the sin of the duel. When the bishop finally relented, Alexander declared,
"I have no ill will against Colonel Burr. I forgive all that happened."
I couldn't. I wouldn't. Not ever. But Alexander said again to me,
"Remember, my Eliza, you are a Christian."
I knew then that it was a plea not for my comfort, but for my forgiveness. And I nodded my head, eager to give him what he wanted and needed before the Lord took him and I could give him nothing else. But in that crucial moment I also turned and fled the room because I knew I'd told my dying husband a lie. After all, how can one forgive what one doesn't understand? How had I not known? How had I let this happen? Why hadn't I predicted that the long rivalry between my husband and Aaron Burr would come to this? After I composed myself, I returned to my husband's side. Then all we could do was wait and wonder if each labored breath would be the last. In the morning, though those blue eyes appeared clearer and tinged with violet in the light of dawn, my beloved lay nearly motionless. And so I did perhaps the hardest thing I'd ever before had to do as a mother. I gathered my darling babies around me and somehow uttered the words, "Your father is dying, my little loves, and we must now say farewell." It was a scene of shattered innocence and grief that I still cannot allow myself to recall too closely. The way those little faces crumpled, the disbelieving despair, the younger ones who cried because the older ones did, not because they understood what was happening, or ever really would. I'd lived 46 years, and I would never understand either. I led the children into the room and lined them up at the foot of the bed so that Alexander might be able to see them all. The fruit of our love. I lifted little Phil, too short to be seen, to give his father a kiss, And then we waited as Alexander gave each child a final look, as if committing them to memory. Suddenly, seeing them became too much, and my husband clenched his eyes shut and pressed his lips into a tight, trembling line. Over the protests of my oldest sons, my sister took them from the room, and I was grateful for it. I wanted to do something, but there was nothing to be done but wait, as a man who had always burned so hot grew ever colder. So I simply held Alexander's hand, determined to hold him through every agony until the last drop of blood. I held on to him with the full knowledge that after this day, I'd never get to do it again. The clock over the mantel ticked out a mournful cadence as the last of Alexander Hamilton's life bled away. Though he couldn't move and had trouble breathing, he retained his beautiful mind and his warrior's spirit until the very end. "If they break this union, they will break my heart," he said, eyes unfocused. Finally, the chimes on the clock struck twice. Alexander breathed no more, and the silence of his passing stole what was left of mine. For I knew that no breath I ever took again would be the same. Chapter 36.
If it had been possible for me to have avoided the interview, my love for you and my precious children would have been alone a decisive motive. But it was not possible, without sacrifices which would have rendered me unworthy of your esteem.
Alexander Hamilton to Eliza Hamilton. July 14th, 1804, New York City. They'd murdered him. First my son, then my husband. Because they thought they could get away with it. And I was sick to the depths of my soul. Sick and enraged. These furious thoughts echoed as church bells rang and flags lowered to half-mast, and somber crowds gathered all along New York streets. And then a military procession wearing black armbands arrived to accompany my husband's body to the church, to take him away. "Come back to me," I silently pleaded, as I'd done all those times he'd ridden off to battle. But this time he would not return. It was not the custom for women to attend graveside services, and I couldn't have borne so many witnesses to my grief. So with my youngest children at my knees, and my sister Angelica's hand clasped tight in mine, all serving to hold me up, the pallbearers lifted the mahogany casket topped with my husband's hat and sword. Two black servants in turbans followed with a dappled gray horse, bearing my husband's empty boots and spurs in the stirrups. Empty boots, empty saddle, empty hat, empty world. The sad staccato of drums brought a keening sound from my poor children, all of whom lurched for the casket, as if to tear it open and lay eyes upon their father one last time. But I had the absurd thought that the casket, too, was empty. That Alexander Hamilton wasn't there. Not in the mahogany coffin I chose for him, not in the empty hat and boots and bed he left behind, not in the city he loved. There was no part of him still here in this world, and I couldn't be where any part of him was now. Clutching the letter he left, which purported to explain everything but explained nothing, I could not shake from my mind his conviction that he must die this way or be rendered unworthy of my esteem. My God, had I driven him to this? He'd been content to putter about our flower garden, to learn about the fattening of our chickens, to go duck hunting with our boys. But I had not, like my mother before me, told him that all I needed for my happiness was his presence. Instead, I insisted he take up that court case, making himself a greater thorn in President Jefferson's side. And I'd gloried in seeing the leonine spark return to his eyes as he battled to keep Burr from the governorship. My God, I did drive him to it. Before we married, Alexander asked again and again if I could happily live with him, were he to lay down his sword to plant turnips. I'd promised that I could. But when it came to it, I'd wanted my soldier. I wanted the glory of Alexander Hamilton. I'd encouraged him to fight. And now he was dead. How long had he known about the duel, and how many times must he have wished to broach it with me? Was he thinking it even as he planned the ball he promised? Had that been his final parting gift to me? Had he believed he'd return? Or had he longed to go to Philip? I'd thought he'd been happy, that we'd been happy, but again, I'd missed all the signs. And I let him face it alone. But I was not the only one to blame. 4 years earlier, Alexander had said he didn't expect to have a head still on his shoulders unless he was at the head of a victorious army. And in a way, he'd been right. Later, much later, I would succumb to anger at Alexander for taking part in an immoral ritual that had already robbed me of a son and now condemned the rest of our children to a life without their father's love. But then, consumed in grief, the only respite I allowed myself in self-recrimination was in blaming Aaron Burr. Our family now lay shattered by the man my husband always warned me was dangerous. Dangerous and despicable. While the papers speculated about which insult or offense had precipitated this final fatal confrontation, I knew the duel was merely the fruition of the conspiracy Alexander had long suspected. The same conspiracy that had dogged my husband's heels from the moment he rose to prominence in opposition to the Virginians. I knew, as deeply as I knew anything, that Burr would not, without encouragement or inducement from the Jacobins, have murdered my husband in cold blood. After all, Burr did nothing unless there was something in it for him. No, I was certain that he'd made me a widow to win back the good graces of Jefferson, a man who may not have brought the guillotine to our shores, but who had the uncanny good luck to have his most formidable enemies meet strange fatalities. It had been many years since I'd seen Jefferson last, but I could never recount him without a chill. Never forget the way he'd haunted my life, like a patient thief in the night, waiting to steal my happiness away. And now he and his minions had done it. The bullet that obliterated my world was an assassin's shot. Alexander had thrown away his fire, then stood there vulnerable and without defense. Burr had shot him anyway. And now that Alexander's lifeblood was drained away, spent in the service of an ungrateful nation, would that be enough for these hounds of hell? They won't be satisfied until there is nothing left of him, I thought. Until his memory is obliterated and they have filled the giant empty void of his life and our nation with lies. But I wouldn't let them. That night I received mourners at the church home, where ambitious young Federalist politicians strode about with smartly upturned collars. Businessmen with pipes sent up a dizzying wreath of smoke, and ladies crowned in masses of coiffed curls bit their quivering lips while offering me words of comfort. All the while I nodded, forcing bland niceties. How kind of you to say. I appreciate hearing it. What a consolation it is to know he was so esteemed. Gracious God, my dear sister, Angelica said, weeping into her kerchief. Here I am, coming all apart, while you bear this affliction with saint-like fortitude. Soldierly fortitude, I thought. Because there wasn't time for tears. I would shed them later. Right now, I didn't want to mourn my husband. I was no saint. I was Alexander's angel, and I wanted to avenge him. I remembered Captain Molly and Two Kettles together. Two women forced to fight when their husbands could not. And I wanted to do the same. At some point, I looked up from a glass of lemonade that my sister had pressed into my hand to find Reverend Mason hovering over my chair. Hamilton was the greatest statesman in the Western world, perhaps the greatest man of the age. He has left none like him, no second, no third.
And I was nodding, quietly simmering, when he added,
To shoot such a man in cold blood, the vice president's heart must be filled with cinders raked from the fires of hell.
But is he to be prosecuted for it? I asked.
Then I stood, abruptly, raising my voice to repeat the question.
Is Burr to be prosecuted for it?
The din of mournful conversation fell utterly silent. The whole of New York society turned to stare, and I met their gazes, each and every one. Then, in a clatter of coffee cups, the gentleman at a table beside me traded glances and made to rise, but I stopped them.
Please don't stand for me unless you will stand by General Hamilton in bringing his assassin to justice.
A coroner's jury had been impaneled on the night of Alexander's death, but they were likely to dismiss it, as they did all affairs of honor, unless I did something about it. My sister's eyes flew wide at my impulsive declaration, but the blood in my veins flowed with pure rage, and I wasn't finished.
I've heard the country is covered in mourning. I can see for myself the city is awash in black armbands, and at the dock there was talk of burning down Burr's house.
A hint of an approving murmur rumbled through the room at the threat of arson and mayhem, but that wasn't what I wanted.
My husband helped make this a country of laws. Will we permit the Vice President of the United States to stand above them?
By God, the Vice President ought not to be above the law, said the editor of my husband's newspaper. Witnesses must be summoned and examined.
Someone added,
Can we learn if it's true that Colonel Burr has been practicing with pistols for 3 months past?
I winced, having not heard the rumor of Burr's practicing to kill my husband. Burr had shown no remorse, no regrets, no mercy, and no fear. But I'd seen enough moments of popular emotion in my time to know there would never be a better opportunity to clasp my husband's killer in irons than now. And I meant to see justice done. In the blur of days following my husband's burial, I donned a widow's armor of black taffeta and lace, startling the owners of every prominent household with a visit, descending upon them with my orphaned children in tow, their eyes still red from crying. It made me ashamed to exploit my children's grief, to expose Anna's derangement to outsiders, but we needed everyone to see the hapless state in which Burr left my family. For now that the Goliath of federalism was slain, even Republicans found the decency to denounce Burr. And because I'd learned the importance, in politics, of reinforcing the beliefs of the voter, I confirmed suspicions.
It was murder,
I told anyone who would listen, stopping just short of suggesting that President Jefferson had ordered it.
Did you hear how Colonel Burr enjoyed such a hearty and cheerful breakfast that his dining companion couldn't believe he'd just shot a man?
This bit of callousness never failed to elicit a gasp. Nor did the revelation that just a month before the evil deed, Burr had shown up at our door at an obscenely early hour and begged my husband for financial assistance to cover his debts. Alexander provided it and more, raising $10,000 in cash for the man who met him at Weehawken bearing murderous intent. In days of old, Burr was the master electioneer, but now I could almost feel the tide turning when I carried my campaign against him to the lawyers, the judges, the bankers, and the captains of industry. No less the candle maker who lived but a few doors down from us, the baker at the corner, the carpenter, and the newspaper men. Burr would never shame or silence me while a breath remained in my body. I wanted his scalp. And perhaps he knew it, because less than a week after Alexander was buried, the Vice President of the United States fled the city under cover of darkness, like a criminal, like the base assassin he was. And I took some solace in having routed him. I'd forced him to retreat, but it wasn't enough, oh, not nearly enough. I wouldn't be satisfied until I forced him off the continent, if not this plane of existence? Then came the verdict of the coroner's jury. Alexander Burr, Esquire, Vice President of the United States, is guilty of the murder of Alexander Hamilton. There it was, in black and white. And when I showed my sister the verdict printed in the paper, I said, "If he ever dares step foot in New York again, he'll be brought to formal trial." Angelica warned, "Please don't set your heart on this. Burr is a clever devil. He'll argue that New York doesn't have jurisdiction because the duel was fought in New Jersey. Well, then I must see that he's indicted in New Jersey, too." The first step is to gather the evidence. That's what I imagined Hamilton saying. I could still hear the echo of his voice, instructing Philip on the finer points of the law. How I wished I'd listened more carefully. Burr was already trying to defend himself with the lie that my husband had fired at him and that he'd merely fired back in self-defense. But Mr. Pendleton had acted as my husband's second in the duel and said otherwise. Moreover, Alexander left a letter for me expressing his intention to throw away his shot. There were likely other letters expressing the same, and I wanted them as proof. Which was why I went with my sister to Alexander's law office the next morning. Upon entering the chamber, I braced myself for the familiarity of it. The sight of his leather-bound law books kept in neat rows upon the shelf from floor to ceiling. The burgundy carpet, a little worn in the path he used to pace while working out his arguments. The sunlight falling upon a desk where his quill pen would never scratch again. Instead, I came upon clerks packing his things into boxes, and the esteemed executors of Alexander's will, Mr. Church, Mr. Pendleton, and Mr. Fish, hovering over his belongings like vultures over carrion, thumbing through his papers, bundles opened upon every surface. For a moment, it felt as if I couldn't get enough air. "What are you doing?" I finally demanded, my voice trembling with anger. Someone tried to greet me in polite acknowledgement, but I was too blinded with rage to see who. All I wanted to do was scream, "Get your hands off his things! Get out! Get out!" Alexander's leather chair was askew. Someone had been sitting where my husband used to sit. They'd even smoked here, for a faint trace of tobacco hung in the air. Yet the greatest indignity was to see that the compartments in my husband's carved desk had been unlocked. And my nostrils flared as I demanded to know, "Has someone taken papers from here?" The men stopped what they were doing but didn't answer, only stared uncomfortably. And I might have shouted at them if Angelica hadn't stepped forward, "Will you gentlemen please excuse us? Mrs. General Hamilton should like some privacy." The men withdrew and closed the door behind them. All but for my brother-in-law, who'd been packing one of the boxes, and now seemed puzzled by my reaction. As soon as we were alone, I rounded on him. "Where are the papers from Alexander's desk?"
"Here, somewhere, I'm quite certain."
Church motioned to the crates and poured himself a glass of port, though it was mid-morning. As an executor of my husband's will, he now held trust over my inheritance, whatever it might be. And he said,
"I'm sure it's all in these boxes, excepting a few documents pertaining to existing legal matters and party business."
My husband's law partner would need to take on Alexander's clients, and, perhaps, matters of import to the Federalist Party. But none of this changed what felt to me a shocking violation. "How dare any of you take Alexander's words from me without so much as a 'by your leave'?" Church leaned against the desk.
"Well, legally..."
"Jack," my sister snapped, gripping his arm to keep him from saying more. I knew he was going to explain that executors had the right to take and sell anything valuable for the payment of debts, my husband's words being the most valuable things of all. I knew and didn't care. Struggling for a calming breath, I said, Sell the chair, the desk, the lamps, the carpets, even the books. But you must promise me that no one shall ever touch my husband's papers but me.